Good afternoon, everyone. My name is John Mann, and I teach public history here at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. And it's my privilege to introduce our keynote speaker, Barb Sommer. I would be remiss if I didn't, as a board member of the Wisconsin Humanities Council, that this presentation is funded in part by a grant from that organization. It's great to welcome Barb Sommer back to our campus. She was here a few years ago serving as a consultant on a Teaching American History grant we had, the first Teaching American History grant we had, which I was directing at that time. And she provided us with some fantastic feedback that really improved the program. And among her the bits of advice she provided was to think about using this book called Dialogue with the Past. It's written for teachers, and it gives them suggestions for how they might use oral history in their classrooms. And as we got to talking more and more about this book, I learned that it had been written by a friend that I'd lost touch with many years ago. So in addition to coming in and providing advice on how to run our grant program, she also put me back in touch with a long-lost friend. So I judge that first trip a big success, and I have every reason to believe that this visit will be just as successful, although I don't know how she's going to top reuniting friends unless she introduces somebody here to a future spouse or something like that. We're very fortunate to have Barbara Sommer as our keynote speaker. She has spent her career in the field of public history, serving as historical organization director and director or co-director of numerous museum and oral history projects, over 20 major oral history projects to her credit. She's had workshops, she's presented at state, regional, national, and international conferences. She's one of the founders of the Oral History Association of Minnesota and the Nebraska Foundation for the Preservation of Oral History, and is a longtime member of the Oral History Association, where she has served as a liaison to the American Association for State and Local History. She's taught at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and Nebraska Wesleyan University, and is the author of a number of publications. We heard earlier about the Oral History Manual, now going into a second edition. I see at least one of my students out there who I can guarantee you, unless she didn't do her homework, is familiar with that book. She is also author of Hard Work and a Good Deal, the Civilian Conservation Corps in Minnesota. This was released by the Minnesota Historical Society Press in January 2008, and Barb learned just Saturday night that it has been selected for a Minnesota Book Award in the Minnesota category. So we can be among the first to congratulate her for that. Please join me. So that's exciting. Her keynote presentation today concerns a forthcoming publication, The American Indian Oral History Manual, Making Many Voices Heard. She'll be talking to us about the history of that publication and its contents. So please join me in welcoming Barb Sommer.
Thank you, John, and it is good to see you and to see everyone here in Eau Claire. I have wonderful memories of working with the Teaching American History grant and also getting lost in Eau Claire, which he and Susan both remember, and I think several others do as well. And I'd also like to thank Troy for inviting me today to talk about the manual. And I did attend last year's Wisconsin Oral History Day meeting in Madison. Sat in the back, just had an absolutely wonderful time, listened to the speakers. Always find this to be just a fantastic program, a good day, energizing for everyone. And again, I'm glad to be here this year as well. As John said, I did last year receive a copy of the Troy's Oral History Manual. I did have an older copy, I think, that I had gotten years ago when I lived in the West and had attended a meeting in Boise, but was delighted to receive the updated version last year that you're receiving this year, and have it prominently on the shelf and do turn to it and use it quite regularly. So appreciate that a lot, that you have this manual available to everyone and that you've updated and that it's made available like this. I think it's a great help to all of us. So thank you again, Troy, for inviting me. And as John said, I'm going to be talking about the American Indian Oral History Manual, and I'd like to give you a little background about that, talk about that manual. But first, maybe a few comments about the Oral History Manual, since Mary Kay Quinlan and I have written several of them. And as John mentioned, the Oral History Manual is coming out with a second edition now in this month, or next month, next couple of days anyway, in May. Our work, and we've talked a little bit about money and how things work with oral history, and our work on the Oral History Manual began very luckily for us and very nicely for us with a small but very helpful Nebraska Humanities Council grant when both of us lived in Lincoln, Nebraska, and Mary Kay Quinlan still lives there. And with that, we were able to start doing a planning project for an oral history project. And so we started putting together our ideas about the kinds of things, the methodologies that people really want to know when doing oral histories, based on our work with community workshops. What are the kinds of questions that people ask just to get started? And we put our heads together, spent about 6 months refining and defining this material, and it became a planning project or a planning document. And with that, we ended up giving some workshops. We did one for the American Association for State and Local History, and then from that, we were asked to go ahead and develop the material into what became the Oral History Manual. And so that was sort of the process. We did look at methodology. We looked at the kinds of things that people are looking for answers about. But how do you think through the equipment issues? How do you think through the copyright or the legal issues? What are the ethical issues that are so important to all of us as oral historians, and how do we do this? How do you go about thinking about asking the questions? So it's a very basic sort of thing, and I know that it works well. I know that Don Ritchie's book is an excellent, excellent book with its question and answer style, and there are many other books that have come out since then that are very helpful in teaching us how to think about and work with oral history, and it's fun to be a part of that, and I think it's exciting for anyone and everyone, as we've heard all day today about how what oral history can do for all of us in energizing the study of history in one way. So today I'd like to talk a little bit about the American Indian Oral History Manual. That too started with a grant. And I should mention too that the subtitle, Making Many Voices Heard, we tacked on because I had read actually Thomas Peacock's Forever Story, The People and Community of the Fond du Lac Reservation. And he wrote, as he wrote in that book, Peacock wrote in that book, across the earth, everywhere, I'm making my voice heard. And we thought, Indian oral history is making many voices heard. That's what we want to do, is make many voices heard. And so we actually did put that as part of the subtitle of the book. And then we looked for ways to actually show that graphically, that we're making many voices heard. So we asked, we sent out a call across the country, would people send us translations of this subtitle? And it came in from North and South America, actually indigenous languages. One came in by telephone only from an Omaha woman who was very, very careful that we had many conversations to make sure that I had written this correctly, because she spoke it to me. But she did a wonderful job in helping us translate that. So the words in the front and back cover are actually the translations of that title. And the list of people who contributed are in the book as well. So we tried to, in a way, it was an interesting way of just working with one phrase in doing indigenous oral information. This project, and I just have a copy of the book here, began with several questions. How are the issues and concerns of American Indian people addressed in standard oral history methods, texts, and manuals? And what information could be most helpful in recording indigenous information? Issues about the relationship between oral history and oral traditions are questions. And understanding of unique legal and ethical issues, how are those handled? And the collection and use of oral information. All of this often is specific to American Indian interests. Is there a place for a guide and source book? The three authors of the manual, and the three authors are Charles E. Trimble, Mary Kay Quinlan, and myself, felt there was. So we wrote it with the American Indian audience in mind, but we hope it contains information that's helpful to people across the cultures, as we've talked about today as well. By way of introduction, Charles Trimble is an Oglala Lakota, an enrolled member of the Oglala Lakota tribe. He was grew up on the Pine Ridge Reservation, and I'll have some quotes from him describing that, and graduated from the University of South Dakota in 1957. So he's a leader among the American Indian rights organizations and a former member of the Library of Congress American Folklore Center Board of Trustees. Mary Kay Quinlan is a longtime oral historian, and if you're a member of the Oral History Association, you will recognize her name as editor of the newsletter. My work with American Indian oral information began with two projects that I did for the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa in the early 1980s, so this has been going on for a while. The second project that I did, a survey of historic sites working with elders on the reservation, became my master's thesis. As an oral historian, I was asked to do these projects, and I began work thinking, well, this is going to be really exciting, and I'm very much looking forward to this, but I realized right even then that about the gaps in how we handle cross-cultural information and the kinds of things that are done. So I've kept an eye on this process over the years. I would read about it, I would look at it, I would try to find information about how this was being done. And then several years ago, when Charles Trimble was on the American Folklife Center Board of Directors, he asked if there would be a way to have American Indian involvement in the Veterans History Project, which was just getting started. So this led to a couple of actions. First, he hosted an American Folklife Center board meeting in Omaha in 2002. And as part of this meeting, the director of the Veterans History Project came to Omaha and talked about doing this kind of work, doing a veterans work with the American Indian population. And then Mary Kay Quinlan and I began to research options that could go into doing some more work and documenting that. We again received a grant from the Nebraska Humanities Council, and this was followed by a grant from the National Historic Publications and Records Commission, NHPRC. So we did have some funding to work with, which was really helpful. Also, the University of South Dakota and the University of South Dakota Foundation provided funding for that particular planning project, in which we looked at how to involve veterans, American Indian veterans, in the Veterans History Project. We tested the materials in several day-long workshops, one held with representatives from South Dakota tribes, and the other with the Winnebago leaders and tribal councils. And after the first workshop, Dakota elder and religious leader Clifford Shanko Sr. wrote a dedication for our manual, and I do want to read that. "This manual," he said, "is dedicated to all Native American veterans who have served their tribal nations as traditional warriors, contributing unique talents, languages, lives, and supportive efforts in the various wars fought against the United States government, by the United States government against foreign nations." It's a strong statement. When Charles Trimble, Mary Kay, and I were asked to expand the Veterans Manual into the American Indian Oral History Manual, we focused on the planning process and oral history interviewing, recording and collecting the information. As Choctaw historian Devin Maheshua has pointed out, there is no single Indian voice. And as others have said, Indian cultures are as different from one another as the Japanese culture is from the Polish culture. With this breadth of backgrounds and beliefs, we realized we couldn't write a tribal or cultural-specific manual, nor could we focus on the wealth of information that's been collected in the past. What we could do is write a manual that could provide a base of methodological information for tribes and Native communities when developing projects and programs for recording indigenous information. So here's how we organized the manual. And you see it's a slim little volume, but it's got, I think 10 chapters. The first two chapters look at an overview of oral history and oral traditions in terms of the recording processes and legal and ethical issues. The middle chapters suggest adaptations for standard recording processes for use by Native people. And the final chapter reviews some uses of oral indigenous information. So what did we find? In terms of literature, we were guided by the writings of Charles Trimble and the work of William Schneider, among many others. Mr. Trimble's writings examine the critical importance of traditional information and of fully understanding its provenance and its content. Schneider's work with indigenous people in Alaska and South Africa, covered in his book, So They Understand, Cultural Issues in Oral History, helped guide our understanding of oral history and oral traditions. We also looked at tribal projects across the country. The Suquamish Tribal Oral History Project is a long-standing tribe of the Suquamish tribe in the Pacific Northwest. The Doris Duke Indian Oral History Projects are another early indigenous recording project that funded work at several states, including the American Indian Research Project at the South Dakota Oral History Center. which documents Northern Plains tribes. The Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians in Minnesota began collecting traditional information in the 1980s from the last generation to speak Ojibwe, the language as a first language. The Hopi tribe and the Seminole people have recently begun active collecting projects, among many others. These are examples, but they help this kind of work help guide our work. What did we find? There are concerns. Philip Sam Deloria, Standing Rock Sioux tribal member, has talked, as Charles Trimble has, about the decreasing emphasis on indigenous oral transmission of knowledge. Now, this is something that's gone on and on, obviously, but it's something that's coming up again. This isn't new, but it's also something that people are continuing to discuss. Historian and Africanist scholar David Hennigy described the difficulty, perhaps in fully comprehending the importance of this situation, when he wrote, "Electing not to remember an event in an oral society, in other words, forgetting it, means it's cast into oblivion and not just on a bookshelf." So in the battle against racism, Dakota author and historian Philip J. Deloria says that Indian scholars are turning toward the more unique particulars of tribal and community history to help document this. This continuing interest in saving information from oblivion and understanding its meaning is seen as a step in the fight for a more complete understanding of Indian people and cultures, a continuing war. As Mr. Trimble recently wrote, "The history of injustice and inhumanity to tribes must be taught, for history not learned is history to be repeated. But history must be taught with accuracy and dispassion as history, and not as indoctrination to give Native youth a sense of resentment or white students a sense of guilt. History and culture are contained in oral traditions. In the manual, we cover the preservation through discussion of recording processes. We cover documentation of the telling and its content, and protection of the information contained in this information. Oral traditions are often sometimes referred to as a static body of information, but they reflect a variety of types of stories and information. And even just looking at content, very simply, we could say that we can identify sacred and epic stories as one example. These stories are passed down with protocols that help define how and when they should be told. They contain information that describes cultures. They are encoded with ritual and spiritual elements, as a team of archaeologists working in the San Pedro Valley recently noted. They are parables. Mr. Turtle calls them metaphors for teaching. The epic story among the Dakota of hunters and the obstacles they faced on the Great Plains is an example. Often compared to the Odyssey, it teaches about overcoming adversities from men's and women's points of view in that culture. Sacred and epic stories also may contain content, such as the Dakota story of the Great Flood, told by or common to many tribes. We should know that. The information in these stories could be based on historical events, but they're remembered and told because of the spiritual and religious elements. Community stories are another type of oral account. They can appear to contain identifiable historical content. The Oneida story about the creation of the Five Nations Confederacy, or the Great League, is an example. This story contains details that seem to define a specific time, when the corn was ripe and the grass was knee-high, and a specific event, when the sun went dark during the day, which would indicate a solar eclipse, that could date the origin of the Confederacy. The story is told by the Wisconsin Oneida. Similar stories can be told by different tribes, too. In the 1950s, community stories, a former president of the Minnesota Historical Society carefully documented a Dakota story about Dakota and Ojibwe lovers on an island in Lake Minnetonka, in the Twin Cities now. Ellen Woolworth, a retired Minnesota Historical Society archaeologist, said the story closely resembles one he'd heard from the Ojibwe. So we have community stories that can come to us from a variety of backgrounds that can perhaps be compared and contrasted as to place and time and story, which helps us understand community history. The stories told also can be family stories. There's increasing interest in family stories, a type of oral documented communication about the past. They describe events remembered and handed down by families. The role of family stories is an area of increasing interest. Joseph Amato, a non-native and not in writing in general terms, has recently written about this in a book called Jacob's Well, A Case for Rethinking Family History. As Amato says in his preface, Family history shows us the people and places who shaped our parents and their parents, making us see ourselves in an immediate lived history. The history often is contained in stories, the best part of our family's past. They join the individual and the universal, and we've noticed with many of the family stories that we've talked about in the Native and the Indigenous populations that the concept of time is not something that becomes part of this. It becomes almost a first-person story, and that's part of what the family history teaches us in the Indigenous cultures, that these stories are very immediate and very important, and they help us understand the history of the communities and the people. A story on a recording in the University of South Dakota collection is one example of a story that's been passed down through time. It was told by a grandfather, who was the narrator, to his grandson, who was the interpreter, as the narrator's grandfather had told it to him. It's the family story of their participation in Little Bighorn. So you have the family story, but you're connecting yourself to the universal and to the history of the people. Such stories help us understand how families within communities understand and shape accounts over time. We also have first-person memories. This is another type of oral information. It seems to be the closest to the oral history that I understand as an oral historian, which can be defined as primary source material created in an interview setting with a witness to or a participant in an event or way of life for the purpose of preserving it and making it available to others. The interviews in the Wisconsin Oneida Ethnological Study, which ran from October 1940 to March 1942, for example, contain many first-person accounts. Responding to questions from Oneida interviewers, the narrators describe their personal histories and their people's history after the Oneida removal from Wisconsin. This is first-person history about 20th century American history from the Oneida perspective. Also in Wisconsin, communications professor and PBS producer Patty Lowe has interviewed people from the state's tribes. And Susan McLeod and the staff of the Chippewa Valley Museum have used personal interviews to help document the history of the Ojibwe here in the Chippewa Valley. I have a couple of examples of first-person interviews recorded for the Doris Duke, the American Indian Oral History Project. The first was recorded in 1969. They're on analog tapes that have been dubbed, but I think the sound is pretty good. The first is with a man by the name of Wallace Black Elk. He's a World War II veteran, and he describes in this snippet about a minute and a half returning from service in World War II. Let's see how loud this is.
Miami, there's a florist where we was brought back, and then from there, I hitchhiked, and we went to Concord for demobilization. In September 6, 1945, I was discharged from the service. So I was supposed to be on reserve duty for 90 days. So I felt I would show Uncle Sam how tough I am, and I didn't want to come back. I wanted to stay in the service. We were able to feel very good about ourselves for defending our country. We always had it in our mind as Indian veterans that we was at war with another country so that our parents could sleep well without fear that our younger brothers and sisters, our aunts and uncles, cousins, relatives would not have to fear. They could sleep well, they could eat, they could go on living. We were willing to lay down our lives for this cause. So I was very happy about my life in the service. And I come home, back to my father's house, and as I returned, they put me in the car and took me to my father's home, and my dad met me coming on a horse. My brothers and sisters were back home, and he was very happy to see me. It took me home, and all my brothers and sisters started crying. They was crying with joy, so happy to see me. My father told me, son, I didn't think that I would ever see you alive. from the Great War, but you have returned, and I am so happy.
And he goes on in this interview then to talk about the ceremony actually that his father that welcomed him back home, and he describes that in detail. It's I wish I could play it. It's about 5 or 7 minutes long, so it's quite a bit longer. But there is good, that's part of just a small part of this hour and a half oral history interview is that information about how he was welcomed back as a warrior coming back from World War II and the importance of that to him. And he describes the ceremony in some detail. So it's a really very interesting insight into the culture of the people and also the history and how the impact of being a veteran and was on a member of the tribe. The second interview, it was recorded in 1995. And in this, Donald Sam Loudhawk, a Vietnam veteran, describes his experiences at the 10th anniversary of the Vietnam Veterans Wall. And again, as with both of these, he's going to be talking about his background and his response to the wall and also the death of his of members of the Pine Ridge and Rosebud reservations because of the impact that had on him.
Do you get all this from your daughter?
Donna.
Washington, D.C.
Washington. And what year was that?
92.
92.
And we were there to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Vietnam Veterans Wall. And at that time, I still couldn't touch it. Couldn't touch the names of my parents. There was something to touch it was. I needed, there was something else between me and the wall, just to touch the names I couldn't do. But I remember that old lady crying and touching the wall. I had to do it. I had to let go of an anger that kept me from doing that, kept me from touching the wall. And now I'm angry at the United States, angry at the people, angry at angry at government. At that time, I didn't know who else to be angry. I didn't know who else to be angry at, but I was just angry. And now, as time went on, I understood who to be angry at, and I needed to release it in some way. Well, in 92, I couldn't even touch the wall. I just went and paid my respects. We did did a little ceremony, myself and Dewey Braveheart, and some of the vets from the Pine Ridge. We went right where the Women's Vietnam Memorial set up right in front of the wall. Right in that general location, on the last day, we remembered all our KIAs from the Pine Ridge Reservation. We did a little Indian ceremony for releasing the soul ceremony. We took some dried meat with us. We did that there. We fed the spirits of all the guys, especially our Indian soldiers. And we had a couple of guys from Rosebud with us. One had a little handgun, so he started singing the pipe song. And we were doing that kind of quiet because it was still dark. When the morning star was out, we started the ceremony.
And then he goes on to, he then describes the ceremony, and he ends up by saying that they attracted African-American people, they attracted white people, they attracted all people, a lot of many Native people, and that it became kind of a cleansing ceremony, and it helped him deal with the Vietnam experience and also with the death of many of his friends. But as you see, you're getting a veteran's experience, you're also getting an understanding, in this there's a clearer understanding of first person indigenous information that helps us understand the history of the people that are on this, the history of the people. Recording stories preserves them. It can record, the recording can serve as a telling of a story, it can document its sound and cadence, and you heard in the first interview, even the slowness with which Mr. Black Elk spoke and the pauses that he had and how that was allowed to occur. That was his way of telling his story. That was his way of making sure that we'd understand in his way, and that the interviewer allowed that to happen and didn't fill those silences with another question or with an encouragement, but allowed him to tell it as he knew he needed to tell it. It can preserve first-person experiences, as in the case of Wallace Black Elk and Donald Loudhawk. It can help preserve spoken indigenous language, as was done in the epic story of the Great Plains Hunters mentioned earlier, in which the narrator recorded it as it was told, from men's and women's point of view, preserving in the process men's and women's dialects. In terms of mechanics, the recordings can benefit from use of equipment and media that have high quality sound. We've talked about that today, with the idea being that it becomes retrievable, the sound be retrievable for as long as possible, and we do talk about that in the manual. Recording stories is not the only part of the process, however. Accurately documenting the recorded information is critical. Oral historians and those working with oral traditions both emphasize this point. Oral historian Linda Shopes recently wrote, put simply, we need to ask, who is saying what, to whom, for what purpose, and under what circumstances? William Schneider reinforced this for Indigenous information by saying, the story's meaning is not bounded by the moment. It can make sense when considered against past and future tellings or against a full understanding of the culture and how we're doing this. It's a small piece of a complicated puzzle. And I don't think we can emphasize this enough. Documenting context as well as content of stories is a critical step. It helps users understand these stories. Who told it? Why was it told? What were the circumstances of its telling? Who is the interviewer, and why was the interview constructed the way it was? Is the story on the recording one that was handed down for word? Is it told in a family? Is it a first-person story as these were? Has the story changed over time? How? Why? What did or does the recorded information mean to the person telling it, and how was this information documented? Where does it fit into the telling process described by Schneider? As an example of the importance of documenting the meaning of stories, some scholars, hearing or reading the Five Nations Confederacy story mentioned earlier with its details about time and place, might think its significance is that we could end up with a date for the origin of the Confederacy. The Wisconsin Oneida who tell the story say this doesn't even enter into their thinking, however. They say the event happened a long time ago, and the significance of the story is not time or place, but that it helps them understand, quote, the cultural meaning of the people, places, and events that shaped their lives. So again, we're looking at how we understand these stories. Charles Trimble described as a child hearing stories of Wounded Knee. As he recently wrote, while the stories of the Indian witnesses condemned the 7th Cavalry's actions that day, these stories were told not to document defeat, but to teach about strength and courage in the face of overwhelming odds. He wrote, my generation on the Pine Ridge Reservation may have been the last to know the old men who took part as youthful warriors at Wounded Knee. Survivors like Dewey Beard, old Joe Hornclaw, and others, these proud old men, still warriors to their dying days, would not admit to victimhood because they had never admitted defeat. They told their stories with pride, albeit with sadness. The Comanche also have stories about wars during the contact period. They aren't told in the context of Indian wars. They're told to describe, as they say, how our ancestors lived up to their expectations as well as provided a road for us. So understanding and documenting the meaning of these stories and the interviews help as important when recording community, a tribal and community history. Protecting the information also is critical. Tribal protocols and oral history standards are based on respect for stories and the people who tell them. Both emphasize the need for ethical treatment now and in the future. Work by the First Archivist Circle is helping lead the way. The legal and ethical chapter in our manual reviews considerations that also help guide this work. The discussion describes steps for ethical treatment of Indigenous oral information. It looks at oral traditions also, not as a unified body of information, but as a variety of types, as the sorts of things we talked about a little bit earlier, each of which may have to be handled in different ways. Are legal considerations for the protecting the tribe's epic and sacred stories applicable to the first person stories? Why or why not? How can various types of Indigenous oral information be handled with care and respect, both for the tribe or culture and for its individual members? These are questions that an indigenous recording programs face, and I might say as an oral historian, we did put just one example of a release form in the manual, and that is the standard copyright form, which there are a lot of questions about out in terms of community stories and epic stories. So that is something to consider. We drew from our backgrounds as oral historians, where we look at the body of information as a copyrightable information. So there are lots of questions coming up. Their questions continue to develop. When doing the research for the manual, I read a number of books that used oral indigenous information as sources. One was Alexander Harmon's Indians in the Making, Ethnic Relations and Indian Identities Around Puget Sound. In this book, she draws on oral information from Pacific Northwest tribes, including the Suquamish. And she's talking about Indian identity and how the fact that the Suquamish people at contact may not have recognized the Suquamish people of today, but that they identify themselves strongly by the cultural identities. And as she makes as a sort of an aside, a point in that book, she describes the fact that the basic concept of being Indian in American history is something that we really have to think closely about, because the people identified themselves by their name, by their cultural and traditional names, and then had to learn that they were Indians, and that was part of the whole self-identification in the contact period. That information has come in part from oral histories that they have done, or from people's discussions about the meaning, carefully documented oral histories. The information helped provide a better understanding of cultural impact during the contact period. The Oneida WPA interviews offer another example. As noted in the introduction to the book based on the interviews, the Oneida people, more than 3.5 centuries after contact, quote, retained a distinctive and well-recognized identity and social and cultural patterns. They do not have to say they are an Oneida, they live it. Their words offer insights that can help us better understand centuries of contact history aided by careful documentation of the interviews. Today, there is a place for the breadth and variety of oral traditions. The growth in collecting indigenous first-person information is expanding this focus further. Sensitivity to guidelines that respect oral information, both traditional stories and first-person accounts, benefit everyone. The information in the memories, whether unchanging or adapted, first-person or traditional, reflects how people understand and shape experiences, power, and identity. It documents the past and is critically important to the present and future of Indian people and cultures. Can the information help dispel our historical inaccuracies and help allow us to realize that we should expect to find Indians in many places, as Philip J. DeLoria has written? We hope the manual, with its base of information, can help with this process, and that the careful and accurate preservation of indigenous information can continue to teach us all. As Charles Trimble recently wrote, lessons we could learn from history help us today in our quest for true self-determination and self-government. We must learn and pass on our stories. We need a true and factual history, taking into account oral histories from time immemorial. Perhaps what would help is a Native American Historical Society, an organization for Indian scholars to do research and write the history and to debate and hone its accuracy. Perhaps our American Indian Oral History Manual will help all of us embark on an oral history journey to do just that. Thank you very much.
We do have time for Barb to take a few questions. There's about 5 minutes before the next session gets started.
So how did you deal with some of the sensitive ceremonial information that most of the time, like coming from Oneida, knowing like my cousin Bob Roth is our favorite teacher, I guess you'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he won't allow me to videotape him or things, but there's things that
actually, what we do is we make some general suggestions, but we really say that has to be handled within the context of the work that you do and how you do it. I know that there was a woman in Alaska, whom we quote in the manual, who did start telling the stories and was actually told that she shouldn't, and then eventually was allowed to continue to do this. And so we talk about the different kinds of processes. But there's also a group of people working in California who are doing a great deal of thinking about that, and we actually refer a lot of some of the information to the kind of work that they're doing. It's a group that's based in San Francisco, and they're doing quite a bit of recording of some of the sacred materials. Because that, well, we can say that there has to be sensitivity to that. Culturally, what we can say is be very aware of that and know that that's a situation that is not going to be easy to deal with. And so that's not really an answer for you. It's an answer to be able to say we have to understand that better. But we talk about the sensitivity to it, but we do not give a process for an individual to be able to do that, other than to say that there has to be some consideration of how that's done. So I don't know if that's a help to you. It probably isn't in that situation. But I think it's one of the most critical things that, you know, one of the most sensitive areas that we would have to talk about. And there were, I mean, there are a lot of people who look at it in a variety of different ways, but we say be very, very sensitive to that information. Be careful about, aware of how it's done within the context of your work. So that's you know, I hope it helps lead to a greater sensitivity for that. It does not give a specific answer for how to handle that, which is something you're grappling with, I understand, I would gather. Yeah. Is that?
Mm-hmm. How do we get a copy of
it? Through the public, I have one today, if you want, but the publisher is Left Coast Press. And John has the information and Troy will have the information for it. So, and basically I think our goal is to really be able to say, let's talk about how to get the information collected and as critical way as possible, and or as make sure that it's well documented and well understood. And I know you do this, and so some of this is going to be, these are some steps that perhaps can help you. If we wrote it with the idea that there are some things that can really help you and some things that can't, but that you can pick the information and look at it and say, if anything in this manual can help, make sure that we record information in the best possible way, then that is going to be a help toward continuing documentation of the information. So that's where it stands with that. We ask for respect for the information that you're talking about.
Okay,
that's it.
Time's up. Thanks very much.